We are going to talk with the author of Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong, and the new research that's rewriting the story. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Where did the notion come from that women were intellectually inferior to men? That our brains can't calculate math and science as well, for example. That we evolved differently than men. That we are more monogamous than men. Some of the supposedly scientifically proven facts about women that our guest says are not facts at all. They're wrong. And we will wonder, why did science get it wrong? And how is it getting it right now? 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question or maybe a notion. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Angela Saini, science journalist, whose print and broadcast work has appeared on the BBC and in The Guardian, Wired, The Economist, and others. She is author of the new book, Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong, and the new research that's rewriting the story. Good morning.
Morning, Joy. It's lovely to be on the radio with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. So what inspired you to dig into scientific research behind gender differences?
Well, it's not actually a topic. Biology is not actually a topic that I cover very often. I have an engineering degree. So in my career, I've tended to cover things on physical sciences, technology. But a few years ago, I was asked by an editor to write a story on the menopause. And I thought to myself, get the girl to do the women's stories. I was a little bit annoyed about that. But actually, when I looked into it, and in particular into the evolutionary reasons why women experience menopause. It's very rare in the animal kingdom. Humans are one of very few species who experience menopause. It was fascinating because there was such a variety of explanations, and it really did cut along gender lines. So, for example, there are a lot of women, particularly in research, who have done work on what is known as the grandmother hypothesis. And this says that hard-working grandmothers are the reasons that women live so long beyond their fertile years, because they're just so crucial to the survival of families. But there's another view, which is mainly propagated by male researchers, which is that the reason women experience menopause is because even older men don't find them attractive. So older men are having sex with younger women rather than with older women.
Oh, my word.
So, you know, yeah, which is just, I mean, the weight of evidence at the moment is with the grandmother hypothesis. But the fact that this controversy even existed and that it really did cut along gender lines was just fascinating to me. And that kind of sparked off an interest in looking at other areas of human biology and women, women's minds and bodies, to see what other controversies there were. And it was mind-blowing. I mean, it really did challenge so many of these preconceptions and stereotypes that I had, and made me question a lot of science when it comes to what we read in the newspapers and in journals about what it says about sex and gender.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how far back does this go? Maybe one of the earliest studies you looked at that had gotten women wrong.
Well, I go back pretty far, so back into the 19th century. I start with Darwin. So Charles Darwin, of course, the father of evolutionary biology. And in his work, his scientific work obviously is hugely influential and hugely important, but he also believed that women were intellectually inferior to men. And this wasn't just written in his books, it was also in his private correspondence. In fact, he corresponded once with a women's rights activist in Boston, Caroline Kennard, and she had heard on the grapevine that Darwin had written in his book that women are inferior to men. So she wrote him a letter to his house in England and said, "This must be wrong. Please can you correct these people who are saying this, because there's no way that someone of your stature, such a great man, could believe such a thing." He wrote back and said, "Actually, that's true. That is what I believe, that women are intellectually inferior to men." And not just that, I don't believe they should even try and catch up, because it would damage the kind of happiness of households if they tried, if they attempted to go out to work and earn a living.
He thought, Darwin thought that women and men evolved differently?
That's right. So the comparison he made is with the animal kingdom. So if we look at the peacock and the peahen, the peacock obviously has this beautiful, bright plumage. The peahen is very plain-looking in comparison. And the reason for this, he hypothesized, was that the male has to work harder for female attention. In order to reproduce, he has to attract the female, whereas the female can reproduce, you know, it's her choice, because she can have a pick. She's the one who bears the babies. So he speculated that it was this competition, sexual selection, he called it, that drove the male of the species to be the more impressive one. And he extended that to humans, that, you know, the male of our species also is, he thought, more intelligent, more creative, more impressive, because he has had to compete for female attention. Now, this idea was kind of extended by male scientists in the 20th century, some of whom inserted the idea of hunting as well. So their view was that in our distant past, men would have gone out hunting and women would have stayed at home, and hunting requires men to be clever, cooperative, to be creative, and this made the male into the more impressive of the species.
Yeah.
But obviously there are flaws to all of this, which is what I explore in the book.
Yeah. And was it the same line of thinking that determined some to say it is scientifically a fact that men are more promiscuous than women and women are more monogamous than men?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the same sexual selection theory that says that because a male has multiple sperm. This isn't true of all species, of course, but it is true of ours. A male has lots of sperm that he can impregnate as many females as he likes, as many as he can get, whereas a female can only have one child at a time. So she has to be much more careful and choosy and chaste when it comes to picking a mate. So the idea was that the male of the species, of our species, is more promiscuous and the female is more chaste and monogamous. In fact, this theory was particularly developed in the 1960s and 1970s. And in the 1970s, Playboy picked it up. And on the cover of one of their issues, they had the headline, "Do Men Need to Cheat on Their Women? The New Science Says Yes."
The New Science Says Yes.
Yeah.
So that was that's where I was going next as well. Okay, this was back in, you know, the 19th century or whatever. But even science from modern days got it wrong.
Yeah, even today there is a lot of work being done on sex differences. Now the problem with sexual selection theory, and it's not that Darwin wasn't correct in a lot of what he was saying. A lot of his work was correct, and we know now that evolutionary theory, of course, is, you know, a very important part of biology. But when it came to women, he drew his assumptions from observations of society around him. So he was quite a wealthy, well-to-do, middle-class, Victorian man. And of course, that influenced how he thought about women. The women around him didn't work. They, you know, they did tend to stay at home. They were expected to be modest. They were expected to be chaste. But that wasn't true of all women everywhere. Of course, it wasn't true of all women everywhere. And this idea that he had that women were weaker was completely built on the fact that of the women that he saw around him, that Victorian society had built around him. And if he had just made the effort to kind of see women as they really were, to study it properly, study the historical context, the social context, as a lot of women at the time did encourage him to do, but he ignored, he would have had a much better perception of women, and perhaps his theories on women would have been much better for it. But on that count, he failed, and that has continued to this day. We live in an unequal society. There is still bias. we're still loaded with gender stereotypes. And of course, that affects what researchers bring to the table. Male researchers obviously are going to bring their biases, just as any other researchers are. And particularly in the early 20th century, when women didn't have as much access to higher education, where in some cases they were barred from the scientific academies, so men really were doing the bulk of the research, almost all of it. It's no surprise, really, that their theories were loaded against women and loaded in the favor of men.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking with Angela Saini, who is author of Inferior. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We are talking with the author of the new book, Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong and the New Research That's Rewriting the Story. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our guest is Angela Saini. She, in the book, outlines a lot of myths and misconceptions about the differences between the sexes that were propagated by early scientists, but a lot of this continues even into modern day, and we are wondering why this is and busting some of these misconceptions and welcoming your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me start this segment with a comment on Facebook where a guy says, "So sick of hearing about girl power. Men and women are different. Get over it." Angela, how different are men and women?
Well, I think the differences seem more pronounced than they actually are in the biology. So it's true that when we look at, I have a son, when I look at him in preschool and I look at the girls, they do seem different. When I look at, men and women out in society, we do seem different. But the question is, how deep do those differences go? Are they superficial differences based on society and culture, or are they deep biological differences that are really rooted in our genetics and DNA and in our brain? And actually, the research quite heavily suggests now that the differences don't go very deep. Yeah. So a lot of what we see is superficial. So, for example, in psychological differences, when we've done studies on and surveys on performance in things like maths, IQ, spatial reasoning, map reading, all kinds of things, actually there are very tiny, if any, differences between men and women. And when we do see differences, often this is because individuals are different. So if you get any two groups of people, there will be differences between them just because there are so many individual differences between us as human beings. So if you've got two groups of women, for instance, or two groups of different ages or anything, two groups of people from different countries, any two groups, even neighbors, would be different because there are individual differences between us. So a lot of it, sometimes when we read surveys or when we see scientific studies in the press saying that there are differences between men and women, often this is statistically anomalous. And actually, when big surveys are done involving lots of people, so we can be much more, the results are much more reliable, these differences melt away. Mm-hmm. In the book, I look at brain, I look at intelligence, I look at evolutionary biology, but it's just astounding how much people still cling to the idea that there must be differences there because they believe that they are there. So your Facebook poster, for instance, fervently believes this, even though the evidence may contradict him, and I'm assuming it's a him, may contradict him.
Yeah,
Because the society is so gendered. We've lived in a patriarchy for thousands and thousands of years. So obviously we're going to seem different on the surface because our lives have been set up to be so different.
But we do see, even today, it was probably 10 years ago that a book came out called The Female Brain by an American neuroscientist, that was saying that the female brain is different than the male brain, and that the female brain is affected by hormones, and that makes us act differently, and so forth. What did your research find about whether that science was right or not?
Well, in the book, what I do is pick apart studies like that. So I pick apart very big, prominent studies into sex difference and ask, how reliable is this research? How rigorous is it? And how significant are the differences that they're claiming to see? And often they're not very big at all. There is absolutely no evidence right now that hormones dramatically affect the male and female brain to make them different. We don't have the evidence for that at the moment. There is small amounts of evidence that perhaps testosterone, for instance, does shape the male brain differently, but that research is in its very early days. And if it does shape it differently, the differences in outcome in terms of how we perform cognitively are not very big at all. So the impact cannot be so huge. I mean, this is a fight that women scientists and women researchers have been fighting for centuries. There's a woman I write about in the book, Helen Hamilton Gardner, an American who lived in New York. And in the early 20th century, late 19th century, she was incensed by this idea that was quite common at the time amongst male neurologists, that the male brain was bigger than the female brain, and that somehow made men more intelligent. It's an idea that still I hear to this day. So she looked into it. She went off. She did her own studies, and she consulted experts. She worked with a neuroscientist. And her brilliant insight, which actually is quite obvious, was that brain size is not a reliable indicator of intelligence. It's relative to body size. The fact that men are slightly larger than women would obviously mean that their brains are slightly larger, too. She wrote a beautiful article in Popular Science to explain this, a myth-busting article. And she wrote, if it were the case that big brains signified intelligence, then surely whales or elephants would be the most intelligent species on the planet. They're not, so it doesn't. And, of course, we know that now. So this is a drum that has been beaten for a very, very long time. And every time another myth is busted and the science is slammed down, people seem to come up with a new kind of territory to explore, to look for sex differences, because they're so desperate to prove that they do exist.
Well, why,
the science increasingly suggests they don't.
Why do you suppose this has been the case and continues to be the case, that that people want to prove that big differences exist?
I don't know, but I think it's partly because in society we believe that they do because they seem so big in terms of gender and in terms of culture. So the fact that women appear to look so different and men appear to be so different, we don't think that could it be possibly because women haven't had the same opportunities as men for such a long time. We haven't been out in the workplace for as long as men have, that, you know, women in many parts of the world are still expected to stay at home, that we have the burden of, you know, grooming and makeup and everything, our clothes are different. There are so many countless layers of society and culture that create the images of masculinity and femininity that we have today. We kind of can't divorce that from the idea that these things may be biological.
Yeah.
We believe that because we see difference, that difference must go right to the root, to the heart of who we are.
Where did the notion that men were better at math and science than women come from, and what's the truth behind that?
Well, presumably it's as it has always been, as it was in Victorian times, that women didn't have access to higher education. Very often they didn't even have the same secondary or primary education as men. So if a woman in those circumstances is not able to exercise her faculties, then obviously she's not going to seem as impressive as a man academically. And that has been the case for hundreds of years. Women haven't had, it was only until the 20th century that women had access to universities, that they were allowed into the scientific academies. Marie Curie won, she won two Nobel Prizes. The French National Academy of Sciences still didn't allow her in. That's how deep this goes. You know, there was an entrenched sexism against women within the sciences for so long. So is it any surprise that when we look back to history, that women don't seem as impressive? But now, as we gain the advantage, as, you know, things are evening out, that women do have opportunities, we see that all being eradicated. Women are proving themselves once more. They're fighting these stereotypes. And as they do, we see them in positions of leadership. We see them all across the sciences gaining prominent positions, becoming professors. And it just goes to show that the differences couldn't have been biological in the first place, because otherwise that wouldn't have been possible.
Gary in Portage is with us. Hello, Gary.
Yes, I just wanted to point out how well that women are doing in the Portage area. I have four daughters that I'm very proud of that have college educations. But according to the newspaper up here, this year in Portage High School, 9 of the top 10 students were girls. In the National Honor Society chapter here in Portage, 29 out of 40 were girls, 11 boys, 29 girls. St. Mary's School here had a knowledge contest. 5 of the 6 winners were girls. And in the area scholarships that were just announced in this particular area, 8 of 9 were girls. So what I guess I'm saying is that girls are there, and that boys better watch out, because they're going to rule the world pretty soon. As soon as they figure out that they have some political knowledge, they'll rule. And I just wanted to say that, you know, girls are doing well in Portage, and I think they are everywhere.
Well, and we have heard this, that girls are, you know, making up most of the, you know, college graduating classes and such as well. So what's happening now? Are girls superior?
I think notions of inferiority and superiority, and this is part of the reason why we call the book Inferior, are dangerous, because they're loaded with assumptions about what makes someone inferior or superior. Is being able to have children superior? In that sense, yeah, then women would be superior. You know, I don't like to put right. these notions on, because I think then we start to enter difficult territory. I don't want to denigrate men at all. What the point I'm trying to make in the book is that we need to question research. We need to question bias where we see it, and be more careful about the way we think about men and women, because creating division and placing division there when it isn't there is the most damaging thing of all. I mean, I have a son. I don't want to think that he's in some way inferior to the girls, but certainly I think part of the reason why, as your caller said, that women, the girls are doing so well in school right now, women are doing so well, is because they're being given the opportunity. And often when you have something you've never had before, you work even harder for it, you know. So when we see differences, where we see males have the advantage sometimes, it's because they're given an advantage. Where we see girls have the advantage sometimes it's possibly because they're fighting for it a little bit more. But the research at the moment does show that the differences are small.
We are talking with Angela Saini. She is a science journalist. She is the author of the book Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong and the New Research That's Rewriting the Story. And we're welcoming your questions and your observations for her at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We go next to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, the endurance of this, to me, is pretty obvious. The idea of patriarchy is a central tenet to the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic religions. You know, Eve tempted Adam in the Garden of Eden. Women were made out of the rib of the man. If you look at the Islamic religion, they get incredibly mad when you suggest at least a certain part of the Islamic religion. If you want to educate the girl, she has to go out with a male in public. She has to cover her head and face completely in some aspects of the Muslim religion. So, but added to this, I think there's a human tendency to maintain an inferior outgroup, and the patriarchy that comes from the pulpit certainly feeds into this. My question for you is, there's been a lot of evidence along the lines that you've written your book on. I'm certainly going to read it. I read the Female Brain 10 years ago. Has this had any effect on the religious teaching of any of the faiths?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. So you're asking whether what part religion has to play in this?
Yeah, that's how I'm interpreting it, Angela. So.
Well, yeah, I would agree with your caller that, you know, patriarchy is interwoven into many human societies and cultures around the world, although I should say not all. There are societies out there that are matrilineal, for instance, or that do give women much more importance and social standing than others. And part of it is religious. It does run through many of the religions, and not just the monotheistic ones, also in Hinduism. You know, there's this idea, there's quite deeply patriarchal ideas. But even outside religion, there are many, you know, many cultural practices and social ideas that expect different things from women. So one I talk about in the book is the moral standard. So I can't think of a place in the world where there isn't a different moral standard for women, that women aren't expected to behave differently, behave a little bit more modestly, mm-hmm. you know, not sleep around, or, you know, not be as sexually promiscuous. And that has an effect on how we perceive women. You know, one of the reasons that Darwin felt the way he did about female and male sexual behavior was because he thought that the women around him were naturally chaste, when in fact they were required to be that way because their religion and their society told them to. This was how a woman was supposed to behave. She was meant to be virginal and faithful to her husband. So, you know, there are layers, like I said, there are layers of culture and society that project these things onto our ideas of how men and women should behave. Yeah. And religion certainly is a part of it. Yeah. And I do look at that because we can't extricate religion from human culture.
We have just a minute before news. How is new research rewriting that story when it comes to sexual differences between the genders? Women are not biologically chaste?
Well, the appearance is that we are. You know, so the idea is that women do behave differently to men, but when surveys and studies have been done, more recently, especially in the West, where, you know, the sexual values might be different, we found that that's not necessarily the case. So one big experiment that was done, I think it was in Germany, and I write about this in the book, intersexual behavior on campus. It was replicating an experiment that was done in the 70s and 80s in Florida, where students were approached by a person saying, this stranger would really love to sleep with you. Will you have casual sex with them? And almost all the men said yes, and almost all the women said no. Now, when this experiment was redone much more recently in Germany, they asked themselves, there are many reasons why a woman in that situation would say no. You know, the fear of violence, mm-hmm. the fear of stigma. In the 70s, it would have been terrible for a woman's reputation to, you know, have casual sex with a man. So when they did the experiment again in a safe space where they said, look, this person is interested in you sexually, would you be willing to sleep with them if, you know, you knew you were safe?
And I have to jump in, I'm sorry, because we have news next and we'll pick up after the news. We are talking with the author of the new book, Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong and the New Research That's Rewriting the Story. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are talking about where the notion came from that women are the weaker sex or the inferior sex, less intelligence sex, why we think that men and women have different brains, and why we think men and women have different sexual tendencies. Are women really more monogamous than men? Well, our guest says that a lot of what we have been told is wrong, that a lot of the science was biased or needed to consider other factors. She's telling us why, and we are talking about how new research is rewriting this story. And I did have to interrupt you, Angela Saini, science journalist, author of Inferior, just before our newscast, when you were concluding a new study that was recreating a study in the 70s that to find out if women were as likely as men to have casual sex. And apparently back in the 70s, women were more reluctant than men to have casual sex when this experiment was going on, probably fearing their reputation or maybe even their safety. But what happened in Germany?
Well, in Germany, the results were completely different. So they did the experiment under controlled conditions. So they recreated the experiment on campus and got fairly similar results to the Florida experiment. But when they did it in a safe space, when they gave women a safe space in, under which to make their choices, the results were completely different. Men and women were almost exactly the same in terms of saying yes to casual sex with a stranger. So this just goes to show that, we have to be careful. Scientists have to be careful when they're designing experiments. They have to control for certain things. And in human behavior especially, we need to do so many more checks and balances because there are so many more factors involved. The fact that, for a long time, throughout most of the 20th century and much of the 19th century, scientists assumed these things about women, that women were more modest and more chaste, based purely just on observations or maybe even their own experiences, really wasn't enough to go on. What they needed was to have women involved in research and really understand women properly, which is what we're finally doing now.
Bernie from Elkhorn called in to ask, in our society, when you look at violence, 99% of the time, incidents like murder, for example, are committed by a man. And what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't look at aggression so much because I think this is a big gray area in science when it comes to, are men more aggressive than females? Is there some hormonal underlying basis to it, and there may well be, but again, there is a social component there. So, violence in males is, it's more prevalent, but that may also be because men are more because they have twice the upper body strength of women, more able to commit violence. It may also have to do with cultural reasons that it's seen more acceptable for a man to be violent in some circumstances than for a woman. And because they do have that extra body strength, extra height, then there's less risk to them of when it comes to being involved in a fight. So I think there are lots of things involved here. This is not, aggression is not actually, and violence is not something I actually look at in the book, I'm afraid.
Let's go to Veronica in Brookfield. Hi, Veronica.
Oh, hi.
Yes, what is your story? You have an experience to relay as a woman working in the trucking industry?
Yes. As a little girl, I was like the barrier breaker, like the rebel. And I challenged boys all along through my childhood and even my teenage years, where I felt that just because I'm a girl doesn't mean that I'm not as strong as you or better than you at throwing a football. So throughout my life, I saw that I did, and I don't know if it's biological or whatnot, but I did see that I can do things as well as boys, if not even better. Like, I tried out for the high school football team, and they told me, you can't play football because you're a girl, and this was in 1990s. So anyways, I'm in the trucking industry now, and it's funny that I took, I guess you could say I'm a tomboy. I took it throughout the years, and now I never thought about being a truck driver. This just kind of came up about 5-6 years ago. And I thought, I don't know if I could do that. That's a man's job. But anyways, I went to trucking school in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm out here working with men, big, burly, hairy, you know, men. And then I'm like 5'2", and, you know, I have nails on right now. I have gel nails. I had a graduation to go to, and, you know, I'm a little bit on the femme side. I look more feminine now that I'm out here, but, like, when I'm in the normal world with other females, I don't seem so feminine. You know what I mean? I feel more masculine. You know, so anyways.
Well, thank you for sharing that story.
Kind of superior out here, you know?
Do you,
wonderful. It's a great story.
And I'm great. Veronica, are the guys treating you like an equal?
You know what? They most of the time, unless they're really old fashioned and they're from an old fashioned part of the country, most of them treat me like their little sister. They hold the door open for me. If I have too many things in my hands, they'll help me to my truck. So to be honest with you, I think it's because of the energy that I put out that, you know, I treat everybody respectfully, and I just pray to God that, you know, I get that same type of respect back. And it's not always like that. Every now and then I'll have one jerk out of, like, you know, a bunch, you know. And I usually put them in its place, too, or I'll just refuse and I'll just, like, walk away from the situation.
Thank you, Veronica, very much for sharing.
Good
to
see you. Great.
Angela, have any, just a response or a takeaway from Veronica's story?
Well, I think, you know, I think a lot of the time, it's interesting the words that Veronica used there. She used the word tomboy, masculine and feminine. But our ideas of masculinity and femininity, or what, you know, constitutes a tomboy, are entirely gendered. The fact is that women can do a lot of the things that men can do, because even though men do have more upper body strength, that's an average. So there will be women who can do things that some men can't do. There's no doubt, in terms of strength, I mean. In terms of intelligence, there's no limit whatsoever. But, I mean, for example, I've been traveling to India and to Africa recently for a BBC documentary. And in Indian cities, you see female laborers everywhere carrying huge numbers of bricks on their heads to construction sites, working alongside men doing pretty much the same work that they're doing. In Kenya, I was staying in Nairobi, there were female security guards everywhere. Just as often as I saw male security guards, I saw female ones. They were almost indistinguishable in that environment from the men. Now, that's not to say there aren't physical differences between men and women. Of course there are, but the fact that our idea is that certain things are masculine and certain things are feminine, and for a woman to cross over into the masculine territory makes her some kind of tomboy, it's not true. Women do have an incredible amount of strength, and they can do many of the things that men can do. And I think Veronica just so perfectly encapsulates that, because even though, by her own admission, she is a feminine woman, she also has the strength and power to do a man's job, or what's considered a man's
job. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how these misconceptions and how science getting women wrong all these years has held women back in society and in the workforce.
Well, I love science. I studied engineering. I studied science at school because, for me, it was this kind of beacon of impartiality. It's rational. You know, it gives you clear answers. I didn't imagine that as I grew older and became a science journalist and actually saw how science operated, that wouldn't be true. So I do think that science should have given us clear, honest, truthful, fact-based answers to the questions about sex differences between men and women. It didn't, and I think that has held women back, because we often turn to biology when it comes to debates about equality. For me, this is the final frontier of feminism. We as women can gain equality legislatively, we can gain equality at home, we can go into the workplace, but if a man can still turn around to us and say, no, your brain is smaller than mine, you are less smart than me, you're not as physically capable as me, then there is nowhere to go from there. So I wrote this book as a tool, really, for women and for men to understand that equality is not just a political ideal. It is every woman's natural biological right.
And we have time for a very interesting question, Steve in Sun Prairie. In fact, we have another listener with a similar question. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, mine's actually a two-part question. You know, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that the differences from a sex drive perspective and brain perspective are really the same between men and women, and there might be some differences, but they're very small. How does that affect transgenderism? And then additionally, when you talked about the sex drive and the studies, I'm curious because there's a lot of establishments that allow for casual encounters, I'll say, among gay men. Never heard about those in front of lesbian at all. So how would you explain those two?
So you're talking about, when you say genderism, you mean amongst same-sex partnerships? Are the trends the same?
Well, transgenderism. So a man says, I am a woman, or a woman who says, I'm a man. If the brains are really the same, how do you explain transgenderism?
And I think we're only going to be able to get into the sexual identities or transgenderism because we only have a minute. I'm very sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is a fascinating topic. And actually, studies of people, I don't look at transgenderism so much in the book, but I think, you know, a lot of how people feel when they cross gender is guided by society's idea of what that sex should be and how they should behave. So I think of masculinity and femininity, however we choose to express it, really as an expression. It's like putting on clothes. It's like putting on makeup. It's a lot of it. Some of it is biological, there's no doubt, and I wouldn't want to deny that. There are hormonal differences there, of course. But how we choose to present ourselves to the world is largely our own construction. So I think, I don't know if that goes any way to explain your question, but another thing I would like to say is one thing I do explore in the book is intersex. So people who, for example, have, who at birth, their sex wasn't easily determined. So they may have been raised as a girl when, in fact, biologically they're a boy or vice versa.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Angela Saini is the author of Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong and the New Research That's Rewriting the Story. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison for producing the program. I'm Joy Kerr-Dean. This is the Ideas Network.